Possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Watch for brochure and KrannertCenter.com announcements of the center's 2004-2005 season of guest artists by May 10th.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we take a look at the financial pressures facing colleges and universities and how higher education is marketing itself to recruit students and faculty. Our guest this afternoon is David Kerp. He's a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. His latest book is Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line, The Marketing of Higher Education. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. David Kerp was trained as a lawyer. He was the founding director of the Center for Law and Education, which pursues equal educational opportunity issues in courts and legislatures. He's also been a journalist. He is the author of 14 books and hundreds of articles. His previous books include Almost Home, America's Love-Hate Relationship with Community, and Our Town, Race, Housing, and the Soul of Suburbia. David Kerp's new book, Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line, The Marketing of Higher Education, is published by Harvard University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Kerp, thanks so much for joining us. Greetings from the University of Illinois.
Celeste, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you as well. Your book begins with the descriptions of two schools as a way to illustrate dramatically how higher education is being transformed. Would you share those descriptions and then reveal the school's identities?
Well, one of the schools I describe is a lovely, elegant, modern campus with ponds and faculty and students walking around, a kind of academic idol with all the latest high tech and students and faculty drawn from around the world, and students saying that they're very satisfied with what they've learned and with the contacts they've made. And the other, at least circa the late 1990s, is a pretty run-down place in a shabby part of a major city. It's a school with a great reputation, but one in which it's admitting more and more of its applicants, and only one in three of those it admits are showing up. It's broke. It's hemorrhaging money. In the past, it had thought a couple of times about moving, and it's in pretty tough straits. Its physical facilities are falling down. Its swimming pool is state-of-the-art. As state-of-the-art as the 1908 Olympics, and so too the physics labs. The second of those schools is the University of Chicago. The first is Hamburger University, McDonald's corporate training school.
When I turned the page last night reading the book and read that, I gasped. Why has the University of Chicago struggled so, and why is Hamburger U doing so well?
Well, I think the University of Chicago has turned around in many, many ways, and a lot has happened since that description, which I described in the time I spent out there. I learned a lot about the then and the now of that school. It struggled, I think, because it was living on the past. It was relying on its reputation as a grand, tough-minded liberal arts college, and hadn't really looked very closely at what it was actually offering students. It was the school ranked last in a survey in terms of student pleasures and student fun, and that's part of life as well. And its academic rigor had gotten a little bit of rigor mortis-y. It was requiring, for example, that students take a couple of semesters of a foreign language, even if they were fluent in that language. And they turned that school around, as I learned during my visit there, you know, in interesting kinds of ways. A lot of which have to do with the fact that they looked hard at what they were doing and looked hard at who they were appealing to, and acknowledged the realities and the strengths as well as the weaknesses of paying attention to the market. Hamburger U is one of lots of corporate training schools. I don't want to push the point too hard.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not the university that you or I or our kids are likely to go to. It is actually accredited, so the community colleges will give you credit for the courses you take there. I think it's standing in the better comparison in terms of the things that parents might want to think about are the for-profit schools like the University of Phoenix and DeVry, which in fields like information technology and business offer a really good education. They're not the old matchbook schools, and what they offer is something that universities, even one as august as Chicago, has something to learn from.
Yeah, that's amazing. These for-profit schools, I guess I'm old enough to think of them sort of from years ago when I would have described them as trade schools.
Exactly. I mean, we used to see the ads for them in matchbook covers.
Right.
Which is why they were known as matchbook schools. I mean, these days, a school like DeVry, which I visited both in Illinois and out in my part of the country in California, in one of the campuses, or 50 campuses, and 90,000 students in class and online. One of the remarkable things about this school is that half its students are minorities, and it trains more black and Hispanic engineers, gives more BAs to black and Hispanic engineers than any other school in the country. So it's doing, given the role that it plays, given the pretty narrow focus it has, it's doing a great job for its students.
And these schools are able to cover costs with tuition only.
They are. The facilities are pretty bare bones. They're not doing any research except for research that's directly related to strengthening the institution. The faculty don't have tenure. They're paid decently, but not lavishly. A lot of the money, as you might anticipate, goes into advertising at the front end and job placement at the back end, and that's what actually attracts students in education and employers for pretty good jobs, $50,000, $60,000 a year jobs for the graduates from the information technology programs are gonna step into. But the schools themselves look like high schools, not like campuses. No football teams, no serious libraries. All those things that devour money are not present there.
What attracts the faculty?
The chance to teach.
Hmm.
I'd say two things. It's a buyer's market in terms of faculty. I mean, across the country, more than half of all people who are graduating with PhDs and going into full-time teaching are going into non-tenure track jobs. So it's a new world. And for those people who really love to teach, there's a large attraction to a place in which students are really hungry to learn. And that is my sense in spending time there, that the students at DeVry, which is the place I focused on, really are excited about learning, and in part because of the requirements of the people who accredit school, all universities, and in part because of the desires of the founders. Almost a third of the courses are non-science courses. They're what we would call liberal arts courses. And students, you know, struggle against that requirement, but I think by the end, when they're doing a technology or a science and society course taught jointly by someone in the humanities or social sciences and someone in the sciences, I think they've got the sense that this matters, that if they're going to have careers and not jobs, this is an important thing for them to be doing. So I don't recommend them as, you know, the panacea. They certainly are not that. And as long as there are Illini who love the football team and the history of the institution and who serve in the state legislature, there will be a strong and robust University of Illinois. But if you're talking about the regional state universities, they really do feel the competition. And one other thing that's worth mentioning is this. A school like the University of Chicago, or particularly a school like Harvard with its $20 billion endowment, could give tuition to everybody and not notice the difference. It could open campuses, two or three other campuses, and they'd be first-rate schools. And it's not just that it doesn't do that. It's not even something that Harvard would think about. DeVry and Phoenix and Corinthian and those places have learned how to clone themselves so that if you're in the Chicago area or Philadelphia or Houston or San Jose, you're getting the same education, the same quality education, and that's also pretty impressive. And, they've learned that there are things like best practice curriculums that teachers can adapt for themselves but can use as a basis. And that, too, is something that we professors could learn a lot about.
These private for-profit schools like DeVry, are they giving community colleges a run for their money?
I think we're at a time in which there is a continuing increase in the numbers of students, and there's a big argument out there as to whether or not schools like DeVry are competing with or complementing the existing schools. That is, whether they're adding to the population of people who go to college or they're really at this moment competing. And the different social scientists will tell you different things about that. But as the number of students going to school begins to slow down, I think the competition is going to be more strongly felt. At the margin, it's felt now in the part-time programs. And I would dare say at the part-time programs at Champaign-Urbana, there are going to be students who are deciding whether they're going to get their MBAs, you know, at a local mm-hmm. DeVry or at, you know, University of Illinois Chicago, or University of Illinois in Champaign. And that's something that everybody who's in that business, I mean, you talk to the folks in University Extension, they're very nervous about the patter of little for-profit feet.
You say higher education is being transformed by the power and the ethic of the marketplace, quoting now, for better and worse. What's changing for better? What's changing for worse?
I'm glad you picked that line, because people sometimes ask me if I'm for the market. And I say, that's a crazy question. It's like asking if I'm for Niagara Falls or against Niagara Falls. It's there as a presence. And the real question is, how do you control it? How do you manage it in ways that harness its strengths and try to minimize the problems? The strengths of the market are that it wakes up dozy institutions to the real needs of the students who go there and to the larger research community and to the people who are supporting the enterprise. It adds a dose of accountability in a world that is all too happy often to carry on with its own agenda without thinking about anyone else, really confusing what's, you know, makes the lives of senior professors comfortable with what's good for the society. It brings in new sources of money from private industry, which sometimes really does produce innovations. It gives students more information than they used to have about schools. So to some extent, it gives them a better basis for choosing, although, as I say a lot in the book, the influence of rankings like the U.S. News rankings on college behavior can be pretty pernicious. But those are some of the strengths of the market. The weakness, I put very simply, universities sometimes forget that they're universities and start behaving like businesses. They turn campus units into profit and loss centers. They forget that they're supposed to be providing support for students based on their need and start hunting around for students who they can woo away from another college, even if their families are making a ton of money. This in the name of the admissions office is a, quote, profit center. They cut back on libraries. They increase the cool things on campus that students like. They treat students as consumers rather than as acolytes in the learning process. All those things. And that those forces, it seems to me, are mounting substantially. Once upon a time, there's always been a market. Always been market forces, always been competition. A lot of it has been healthy, but what's happened is it really, those forces occupy center stage, and whether you're talking about hiring faculty or recruiting students or doing research, the market is right there as a force to be reckoned with.
Mm. At the close of the introduction to Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line, you quote an economist who said, "There is a place for the market, but the market must be kept in its place." Are we at a time and place where the market is running roughshod over higher education?
I think we're at a pivotal moment, which if there isn't a serious public conversation about this set of issues, the market could take over higher education, could turn it into something that really does just approximate another sector of the economy. Look at what's happened to healthcare, for example, in the last 30 years. The big winners in healthcare are the insurance companies. The big losers are, among others, the 40-plus million people who are uninsured. And it's not a system that anybody could really be happy with, but it really is a market-driven system. Just ask your doctor if he or she is on a health plan, you know, what it costs to see you for an extra 5 or 10 minutes, given the amount of money they'll receive from the system. And that kind of force, that kind of pressure, exists now, and with states cutting back in the proportion of their support and the press to increase tuition and the huge gap in access that exists for rich and poor kids. The sort of notion that higher education is a private good, it's really an individual investment. It's really, you know, it's like buying a car, except it's a better deal than buying a car in terms of payoff. That idea is really alive and abroad in the land, and so too in the state legislatures is the idea that what we're paying for when we the state, supports universities is immediate economic impact, short-term boost to development, like a tax cut. And that really isn't the way serious research often works.
Hmm. Well, this the rising tuition rates are killing people. The tuition keeps going up, and in Illinois, you know, now the tuition you pay as a freshman at a public university will be what you'll pay as a senior. I believe that's been passed into law. Have other states gone the same way? And, you know, what does that mean for the fiscal health of public universities?
Well, universities, you know, you can't take blood out of the proverbial stone. What universities are doing to make up for the fact that states are cutting back in their support, and this past year, for the first time in at least a decade, the absolute number of dollars that went to universities from states declined, is they're raising tuition and they're getting the kind of response that happened in Illinois. That makes a whole lot more sense to me, by the way, than what's happened in a number of states where tuitions have been frozen for 10 years. A state like Colorado did this. Virginia did this for a while. And so what are those states doing? They're turning to out-of-state students. University of Oregon makes more money from its out-of-state students than from its in-state students, so it goes recruiting after them. When I was visiting University of Massachusetts recently, they just hired a PR firm to go after out-of-state students to extol the virtues of bucolic Western Massachusetts. And the reason is not because there aren't needy students in-state who could benefit from an education, or that the state university has sort of forgotten that it's like the University of Illinois, you know, has land-grant roots, has public service obligations. It is they have to pay the bills somehow. And that's one of the devices they're using in desperation to try to balance the books. They're also cutting back in the invisible things. Even as universities are spending a ton of money on the amenities, the ice skating rinks and the big jacuzzis and the sushi bars, the library budgets are shrinking and the IT program budgets are shrinking because those aren't things that the student consumer or the family consumer sees when they come to the campus.
Hmm. Espresso bars and jacuzzis are nice amenities, but if we look at students as customers, does it have an impact on the institution's expectations of students in the classroom?
Oh, enormously. I mean, my favorite story, by the way, is the University of Vermont, which is a really good state university, decided to spend a ton of money building an ice skating rink. And I thought, you know, next to Siberia, there's probably more ice per student or per person in Vermont than there is any place on the planet. And to build an ice skating rink is another lure to students, just seemed to me to be a silly kind of thing. But indeed, if a student is thought of as a consumer, then his or her wishes have got to take pride of place. That means you don't push them too hard. It means that you offer the courses they want. It means that you get very nervous about requiring courses because requirements are, by their definition, things that some people aren't going to like. It probably has led to the grade inflation that we've seen over the last quarter of a century. It certainly has led to the shift away from the liberal arts into the so-called practical arts, like business management and recreation studies and the like. So it's had a profound effect. There aren't grown-ups in the university who are standing up and saying, you know, we know something. We really have some things to teach you. We together can make you a more informed, smarter, more interesting, more intellectually curious individual, because it's hard to tell consumers that this is what's good for you. You know, take your medicine.
Well, you know, espresso bars and jacuzzis and ice rinks, again, nice amenities, but they don't make necessarily for a good education. And you, in the book, report that students report what is important is not the quality of a school's education, but its prestige. So how do the amenities and prestige come together? What makes for prestige?
Well, what makes for prestige more and more are those blessed rankings. And I don't know a school, whether it's Harvard or the University of Illinois or, you know, Beloit College, that can't tell you immediately what its rankings are overall and what different departments' rankings are, and doesn't respond to those rankings. So they become vitally important, because what happens as you rise in the rankings is you're suggesting you get better students in terms of grades and SAT scores. You get faculty members drawn because the students are better, because the reputation of the school improves. You have alumni more willing to make contributions. You have corporations more willing to make contributions with the institution. And so universities, the problem with that is that universities start behaving in really weird ways in order to improve their reputation. I mean, the funny example has to do with the percentage of alumni who contribute. It's one of the factors that U.S. News takes into account, is what proportion of your alumni contribute to the university. And so Cornell University, among others, decided that anybody who hadn't contributed for the last 5 years was dead. So they just removed them from the rolls. And so, well, you know, the percentage of folks who are contributing goes way up if you've eliminated all those folks who haven't contributed for 5 years.
Does that mean you get taken off the list for people to call you?
Of course not. Of course not. I think it's harder to get rid of, you know, spam, you know, those callers than it is to get rid of the spam on your email. They track you from the moment you arrive in the door. The more pernicious issue seems to me, the big one, has to do with early admission. Early admission the numbers of students admitted in early admission has risen enormously in recent years. And there's no good academic justification for this. The justification has, again, to do with U.S. News. The more selective a school is, the better its ranking. And one way U.S. News defines selectivity is, what percentage of the students that the university accepts actually enroll? Well, on early decision, essentially everybody that the university accepts enrolls. So what does this mean? It means universities really go out of their way to give a break to students who apply for early decision. That applying for early decision is worth 100 points on the SAT test. It makes it 50% more likely that you're going to get into one of the highly selective schools. And what's really problematic about that is that the people who can afford to apply for early decision are those that don't need to make the best deal in terms of financial aid. So it becomes a real leg up for wealthy parents. It's one of the reasons why, as a recent story in the New York Times reports, at the University of Michigan, I mean, which is after all a state school, there are more children from families earning $250,000 a year or more than there are children from families earning less than $38,000 a year. That's stunning stuff. And these are the kind of market-driven factors that head you in that direction.
And for us as a society, that's gonna cost us long term, isn't it?
Enormously, with all this attention that we're paying to the outsourcing of jobs, it seems, you know, nobody is quite recognizing that the next generation of knowledge workers are going to come largely not from the relative handful of very well-to-do kids, but from the working class and lower middle class and poor families who make up a great chunk of the society and who are much less likely to go to college, much, much less likely to graduate from college. And when they do go to school, they're going to second and third tier institutions by and large. The president of Harvard, Larry Summers, made headlines recently when he said that he was not going to require that the parents of students and from families that made less than $40,000 a year pay any loans, that they were those students from families earning less than $40,000 a year were going to get full scholarship to Harvard. Well, the only problem with that is, you know, you can count on almost two hands the number of students from those families who are actually at Harvard. Harvard has about the lowest percentage of kids who are eligible for the federal Pell Grant of any school in the country, about 5% of the students. That means about 5% of the students come from families earning less than about $45,000 a year. That's just, I don't know, it's scandalous, depressing, or both.
Something else that schools are doing in an effort to boost their rankings, they encourage lots of applications, even though it's obvious that maybe the people that they're encouraging, the young people that they're encouraging to apply, aren't going to make the cut.
Exactly. That just seems to me to be entirely immoral. And again, that practice, encouraged lots of applicants, so you can reject lots of applicants, is driven by these rankings. The rankings are looking at selectivity again, and one measure of selectivity is what's your rejection rate. So everybody wants to look like Harvard, which rejects 7 out of 8 applicants. And many of these schools are now rejecting tons and tons of applicants. Encouraging students to apply who they know are not going to be admitted just seems to me to do an enormous disservice to the student, to his or her family, and to the community. That practice becomes widely known. It's going to have the kind of effect on people's trust of universities as the recent evidence of American soldiers torturing Iraqi prisoners is going to have on Iraqis' view of Americans. You can stop respecting the institution because it's behaving in ways that cost you its respect.
Mm. Integrity, is it currently part of the prestige equation?
It isn't, and I don't want to paint an entirely gloomy picture. The book is, you know, a balance of stories of places that really got it wrong, places that got it right, and places that, it, like Chicago, sort of struggled to write the balance. And I would say that at institutions not necessarily or even particularly at the top of the pecking order, a place like Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, which I spent some time at and write about, there's lots of attention both to the market realities of how it is that you strengthen a liberal arts college and the values of a liberal arts education. So that's certainly a school where there's a substantial amount of integrity. A very different kind of institution is the University of Southern California. They went out, like everybody else, to raise a ton of money, but you know, there are presidents from institutions that, for the moment, remain nameless, that go after donors, and whatever the donors want is what the university gets. And there are others, like Steve Sample at USC, who said, I've got a vision. Here's what's really important for our university in the 21st century. And he has persuaded donors to part with something like $1.5 billion, and that effort never ends. But, you know, has been able to mount a very successful campaign. Or, you know, there's a new president at the University of Arizona named Michael Crow. And among the things that Michael Crow has raised money for is a $10 million endowment for a creative writing program. Well, that's just wonderful, because this is very much the neglected part of university life. It certainly is not in any obvious sense going to produce a return on investment, but it's just a great thing for the health and life of a university. So yeah, there are indeed university leaders with integrity, and I think most university presidents are trying to do the right thing. I was recently addressing the presidents of the 60-odd research universities, including the quite remarkable president of the University of Illinois, Nancy Kanner, who I write about in her earlier life as the provost of the University of Michigan. I have enormous admiration for President Kanner. I think she's
the chancellor.
Chancellor. Yeah. Kanner. She's doing she has a great history, and I assume is doing very good things at the university. She's... Many of these presidents and chancellors that I talked with, it's as if they're on rafts going down, you know, class 4 rapids, and they're holding on for dear life and doing whatever it takes to steer their way through a very treacherous course. It's a tough time to be the president of the university.
Chancellor.
But I think if you lose a sense of what you're about, if you become just a business, it's not a healthy thing for the institution in the middling run, and certainly not a healthy thing for higher education. Mm-hmm. You might get more money in the short run, but you're going to pay the price down the road.
Chancellor Kanter is leaving us.
Ah! I'm sorry to hear this.
Yeah, and also our president is retiring.
Mm.
Got any advice for recruiting?
Well, I think this is very interesting because how long has Nancy Kanter been at
Illinois? Not long.
Not long. I mean, this is in a way, in a sad way, this is sort of underlining the point I make. The discussion of her at the University of Michigan talks about, you know, her rolling back some very business-like practices that really did harmful things to that university. And people knew about this, and the University of Illinois grabbed her. And, you know, now somebody else has discovered or rediscovered that Chancellor Kanter is a is a special character in a world where there are very few really standout leaders, and has nabbed her.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Professor David Kirp. He's a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. His latest book is Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line, the Marketing of Higher Education. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk about the head positions and fafaculty, star leaders. How do universities go about recruiting these people and holding on to them?
Well, star faculty is one of the main ways that universities that want to climb up this ladder make their reputation. And there are, as you might imagine, a handful of superstars. Some of them are people who are really well known in their field and really respected in their field. Some of them are people who are very good at raising money. Some of them are people who are just very visible public figures. The way universities recruit them is they offer them huge amounts of money. Often they'll give them their own research centers, and they'll promise that about the only time they ever see an undergraduate is walking across the campus or getting them coffee in their offices, but not teaching them. And it's a strategy that, for a number of universities, has worked very well.
How does it benefit those universities?
Well, it gives them... It's an interesting swap. What the star gets are all those perks that I just described. What the university gets is luster, prestige, buzz, whatever you want to call it. And that, again, translates into dollars, into better students, into a better reputation. In this pretty cutthroat competition world, that matters to many folks. And so, again, to take the story of New York University, that's the great success story of the last quarter of the 20th century. They were bankrupt, essentially, in 1975. And this is basically, they raised money, and instead of increasing their endowment, which is classically what universities do, they said, we can't afford to wait for endowment to ripen. We've got to spend it now. And they spend a ton of it bringing people into the campus. And in all the ways that I've described, NYU is better off. The problem is that it's not yet really a university. It's more a collection of fiefdoms. And it now has a president, John Sexton, who's one of the great leaders of any American university, who turned the law school, when he was dean of the law school, from a law firm, basically, into a working community, and is trying very hard to do the same thing with the campus as a whole. And I hope he succeeds. The problem he'll encounter is that there is going to be out there some other university that wants to rise up the ladder that's willing to hire somebody away from NYU and say, you know, you can teach less with us, or, you know, we'll pay you even more. It's a hard game in which to play.
Mm. Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Savoy on line one.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have to say that I found much of your discussion to play into what are popular prejudices and haven't necessarily seen anything enlightening. The one comment that just really threw me here is when you talked about professors who sit in their labs, who are stars, who never see undergraduates. I've made that same argument to people who've said, well, gee, when that person is bringing in $2.5 million that helps support the school, which pays his own salary, which runs his own lab, which pays for his research assistants or hers, do you really want that person, who may be a research professor, teaching undergrads? Thanks for letting me rant. Interesting program. Bye.
I think that's a very interesting point. And if that particular professor were off at, you know, Illinois, you know, Technographics Inc., a private company, I'd say bravo to him or her. But if you're going to be at a university, part of what you should be doing is training students. Now, when I was thinking about most of the professors that I focus on in the book are people who are teaching in the arts and letters and social sciences. So they're not bringing in grants of the size that the caller suggested. But even those professors, it seems to me, ought to be training the next generation of graduate students, not just focusing on the postdoctoral students, which many of them do. That's what makes them part of a university. They're not just a cash cow that's bringing in a net balance to the institution.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. You may know that we have this controversy with our chief of Illini, whatever, being a Native American mascot and all that stuff, or honored symbol, depending on what side of the fence you are you from. I was wondering what your opinion is and how do those issues affect the university and their marketability, profitability, and all that stuff. You know, does it help or impede? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Well, I feel delighted that the University of California has a bear as its mascot because it's enabled us to stay out of the controversy that Illinois and Ohio State and Wisconsin and Stanford and a number of other places, not Wisconsin, have gone through. I don't think the fight is worth it. That fight is worth it. I do think, though, it's important to look at the place of athletics at a university like Illinois or indeed across the board. They're huge investments. They are, in the terms of the earlier caller, losing investments for most people because very, very few schools actually make money from football teams and basketball teams. They invest a ton. They often compromise academic standards because they admit students who otherwise wouldn't be admitted. And more sadly, they treat those students as if they were day laborers. If they don't make it on the football or basketball teams, they lose their financial aid. They frequently don't graduate from school. And here I'm not talking about any particular institution, but about the problem, the issue more generally. This is another area in which institutions, it seems to me, have run willy-nilly into a land in which they think it's important for them to really, really do well if they're going to hold on to alumni support and if they're going to generate revenue. And I suspect that is not true for many places. Now, University of Nebraska, I remember being in Lincoln at a football game day, and I was told that the football stadium at Lincoln was the third biggest city in Nebraska on that day. So that's a very special kind of place, and I have no idea that there are loyal Illini playing, watching football and basketball. But it's problematic. The theory was that you turn over the regulation of the sports to the university presidents, and good things would happen. A lot of that regulation has been turned over to university presidents, and they're very scared about what it is that might happen. And this, by the way, last thought, it's a particular problem at small, prestigious private colleges. Take Amherst College, where I happen to go. There are 1,600 students, 800 males. Football team has about 80 members. That means one out of every 10 Amherst male students has to put on a helmet in the fall and go play football. Think of what that does to the admissions process at that school. So it's a serious problem worth talking about in just the context that the caller suggested as part of this push to promote market values at the expense of other values on the campus.
Yeah. Well, also, I think that in this community, in this state, the chief has been very divisive, and I wouldn't be surprised if it played a role in the chancellor's decision to go to Syracuse.
Mm.
And I wonder if that will have, you know, how it will play out in trying to recruit a president and a chancellor.
At the end of the day, the chief will go. And I say that only because every place else, the chief or his counterpart has gone. You know, it's now the cardinal at Stanford and not the chief or the Indian. And that's happened in many other schools as well. And it seems to me that the only way to proceed is to bite the bullet and make sure that that decision is made, you know, as clearly and cleanly and carefully and directly as possible. I mean, it's I'm sorry to hear that that would be what would drive a chancellor away. It tells me something about you know, both the depth of the controversy and the priorities that people place on things that matter and things that don't matter so much. But as I say, at some point, whether it's next year or 5 years or 10 years down the road, Illinois will find a new mascot. And 10 years after that, people will be wondering what the fuss was all about.
Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Champaign, line one. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Well, I want to quickly get on the air with a non-chief question because I suspect otherwise we could...
That's probably the third rail of Illinois conversation.
Yeah.
And not one in which I have some special expertise, let me add.
That's a wonderful metaphor, third rail. You got
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so to avoid that explosive controversy, let me go to a slightly different question. And that is, how... When we talk about the forces of the market entering into... or not entering, but perhaps becoming more prominent in the realm of higher education, and you talk about marketing universities, is there any way in which, or do you see a way in which universities can market some of the traditional values of the university? In other words, market the idea that a curriculum should be free and not necessarily head directly towards a job, market the idea that a university, say in a humanities or in a social science division, has a research function, which is important to culture. And again, it won't necessarily show up in a bottom line sense, but has been always a part of university life, and arguably should continue to be so if a lot of the value of the university isn't to be lost. So, how is there a way in which universities and colleges can market some of their traditional values? And I guess I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
I think that is the question that, you know, if you were on The Apprentice and you got the right answer, you'd be working for Donald Trump at this point. It's the question. The University of Chicago, to go back to that story, has done a much more effective job of marketing itself, and it was the first school actually to reach out to sophomores, which strikes me as pretty early on in the game. But the tagline of its marketing brochure is "The Life of the Mind." That definitely describes an audience and leaves some folks out. And it's very impressive. I don't know any other place that would be brave enough to put "The Life of the Mind" as its banner line on the cover of its recruiting materials. I don't think that anybody, whether it's academics or university presidents or journalists covering these institutions or political leaders, has done a decent job of articulating in 21st century terms the power of a liberal education and the value of a liberal education. The best way to do it, I think, is through stories, which is what I try to do in the book, to go to places and see what's working and talk about what's working and what isn't working. But when I was talking to those university professors, I asked how many of them knew about Jon Stewart's Daily Show. And, you know, 60 people, zero hands. And I said, well, this is where your students are getting their news accounts. And,
wow.
You know, it's not a bad place to go. And there's somebody out there among you, I said, I don't know who it is, who would be a great guest of Jon Stewart's. And that's how you have to think about talking to people, not producing, you know, the stuff that those of us in the, you know, preaching to the converted already know about, but how is it that you reach people with a sense of why does this matter? And I do think that stories of why it matters, you know, ordinary people stories of what it was that they got from college, the are going to tell the tale a whole lot better than the kind of rhetoric that academics and administrators are pretty good at puffing up.
Yeah.
But we're not there yet.
Yeah, the best part of college, I thought, was that. What was the interaction between people and ideas, even though I was studying journalism, which you could argue is a trade. When I was in literature courses, I had the time of my life, you know? and history, and I think that's what made it all worthwhile for me.
No, it's to be exposed to ideas, to be exposed to ways of thinking about the world so that you can pick up a magazine or pick up the newspaper or watch a movie or get involved in local politics and have a way of thinking about that stuff that takes you past the headlines, that allows you to think for yourself. That's the joy, not any sort of particular book that you read or a little nugget that you stored away as a nice factoid. It's that ability to think creatively and to think for yourself that's the most important thing that universities can provide. And they're likeliest. That'll happen all over the place. It'll happen in journalism courses, and it'll happen in engineering courses, and it'll also happen, you know, quite directly in the kinds of courses you're describing. And if those history courses and literature courses are well taught, they really will give you, as my students say, a mental headache. They'll make you think very hard.
Yeah.
And they'll make you think for yourself. That's something that the world does not, you know, press you to do a lot. And to have that training, to have that talent is a great blessing.
We have to wrap up here. I'm already straying past my time, but I do have one more question, if you could do me the favor of giving me a brief answer. I have a friend who wonders if brick-and-mortar campuses have a future. How is distance learning affecting colleges and universities?
Distance learning is reaching lots of folks who otherwise couldn't be attending brick-and-mortar universities. But I don't think there's a substitute for the kind of interaction and exchange of ideas that you were talking about a second ago. So there will always be an intellectual place for those institutions. And so long as people care about football mascots, there will be brick-and-mortar universities.
Professor Kerp, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been a great pleasure.
David Kerp is professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. His latest book is Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line, The Marketing of Higher Education. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much. The last from the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, the oil seeds finished the day mixed, that's the soybeans in particular, with the deferred contracts August on out higher, but the nearby May's and July's lower. From the coarse grains floor, the corn and the wheat were both lower. May wheat, 407, the high today, low at 398, a settlement price at 399. They were down 4.5 cents. July futures at 416, the high, the low at 405.5. A settlement there at 408, down 3.25. And September contract, 422, the high, the low at 411. A settlement price at 413.5, 2.5 lower. In December futures, 430, the high, the low at 419. Settled 423.25, down 1.5 after that big up day yesterday in the wheat pit. March futures, 431.5, the high, the low at 424.5. A settlement price at 428, down 1. I got to tell you that it looks like the weather program has really set in Chicago, and they're just moving markets on whatever the weather forecast happens to be for the day. Let's talk about that with Paul Cooley at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock. This afternoon, May futures 317, the high, the low at 311.5, settled 314.25, down 3.5 in the corn pit. July futures 322.75, the high, the low at 316.5, settled 319.75, down 4. And September 319.5, the high, the low at 314.25, settlement price at 316.75, down 4.25. December futures 318.75 high, low at 313, settled 315.25 down 4.75. And March futures 321.25 the high, the low at 317.25, settled 319.25 down 4 cents. May corn 323 the high, the low at 318, settlement price 320.25 down 4. And July futures in the corn pit 322 the high, the low at 318, settled 319.5 down 4. And December 279.5, the high, the low at 278.5, settled there at 278.5, down 1. By the way, did you check your mailbox? There's a letter there, or will be soon, from the FSA. They're requesting that you repay, if you've got it, the advanced countercyclical payment. We'll talk about that today, too, during the closing market report. May oats 173.5, the high, the low at 167.5, settled 173.5, up 2.5 for the day. And July oats 179, the high, the low at 173.5, settled 178.75. They finished a penny and 3/4 higher. From the soy complex, the nearby contracts down. May beans 10.42.5, the high, the low at 10.29, settled 10.34.5, down 3.75. July 10.26, the high, low at 10.12.5, settled 10.20, down 1.5. August futures in the bean pit 9.64, the high, the low at 9.53, settled 9.59, up 3. The SEPs were up 7. They had a high of 8.47, a low at 8.36, and a settlement at 8.45.5. Once again, they were 7 higher. November futures, your new crop, 7.89, the high, the low at 7.70, settled 7.86.5, up 10.5 for the day. January. 785 the high, the low at 773. Settled 783 and a half, up 9 in March beans. 773 the high, the low at 757. Settled 773. They were up 9. May bean oil, a settlement price at 326.20, up 380 for the day. And May bean, that was the bean meal. Now the bean oil. May contract, 33.89. They finished 32 higher. Here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. A higher day today on the Mercantile Exchange in general. May feeder cattle, today's high $100.95, the low 100 even. The settlement $100.45, that up 32.5. August 100 even, the high 98.75, the low 99.27.5, the settlement that down 27.5. September feeder cattle 98.50, the high 97.60, the low 97.95, the settlement that down 5. May live cattle 87.15, the high 87.15, the low in settlement, and that was across the board there. Let's move on to June live cattle 86.30, the high 84.90, the low 85.45, the settlement that up 87.5. July live cattle 88.50, the high 87.25, the low and the settlement that down 25. August live cattle 85.95, the high 84.55, the low 85.42.5, the settlement that up 17.5. May lean hog 75.75, the high 75.10, the low 75.45, the settlement that up 87.5. June 75.45, the high 74.25, the low 74.35, the settlement that up 50. July 75.95, the high 75.20, the low 75.77.5, the settlement that up 90. August lean hog 73.12.5, the high 72.40, the low 72.82.5, the settlement that up 50. May bellies 119.85. The high 117.80, the low, the settlement today 119.85. That up the limit up 300. Now let's take a look at the Dow, the Nasdaq, and the S&P 500. The Dow currently down a fraction. The Nasdaq up 10. The S&P 500 is 3 higher.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Doug Crabtree from Andover, Massachusetts writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why can't you divide by zero?"
I can and often do divide by zero, but only after I've made the necessary preparations. First of all, I fast for 48 hours, consuming during that time only mildly fluoridated water. Next, I don my special Mylar Teflon Division by Zero suit. Then I put on a digitally recorded compact disc of Gregorian chants and begin with dividing very small numbers by other very small numbers.